Hello everyone, I'm Rachel Moss. I'm a transfusion practitioner and I currently work at Great Ormond Street Hospital in London. I've been a transfusion practitioner now for 20 years and I'm also deputy chair of the International Society of Blood Transfusion Practitioner Group. In today's podcast, we're talking about how to build a case for a transfusion practitioner known as a TP in your organisation. If you're not sure what a transfusion practitioner is or what we are, you may want to go back and listen to our first ever podcast about what is a transfusion practitioner. To summarize, the title TP is a common term that's used by countries to describe roles such as transfusion nurse, transfusion safety officer, transfusion quality officer, hemovigilance officer, hemovigilance nurse, transfusion clinical nurse, nurse consultant, PBM coordinator, or practitioner. To name just a few, transfusion practitioners come from different healthcare backgrounds, commonly nursing and scientific, although in some country, medical officers may undertake the activity. The goal of the role of the transfusion practitioner is to improve and support the safety of transfusion and implementation of patient blood management, known as PBM. We are very fortunate to be able to bring you our series of podcasts thanks to the support from the ISBT, International Society of Blood Transfusion. ISBT is a global community of professionals sharing knowledge to enhance transfusion practice and blood management. The society does this by providing opportunities for advancing knowledge and education and by advocacy of the welfare of blood donors and patients. ISBT has many working groups that focus on specific topics or areas of practice, and one of those is the transfusion practitioners subgroup. So today, I have the pleasure to chat with Dr. Naomi, who will give you her full name because I don't want to say it and make it all wrong. So Dr. Naomi will give you her full name, and she will introduce herself in a moment. We are delighted that she's here because she's really recently been involved with building a case for setting up a transfusion practitioner role. So Dr. Naomi, can you tell us who you are, where you come from, where you work, and thank you so much for joining us today.
First of all, thank you. It's a great honor for me. And my full name is Naomi Rahimi Levine. Actually, I was born in New Zealand, but I come from Israel and I live near Tel Aviv. I work for a big hospital called Shamir Medical Center. We have a blood bank. We provide blood for hospitalized patients and for ambulatory patients. And that's about me.
Fantastic. This is going to be such a great chat. So let's start from the beginning. Could you tell our listeners why you thought having a transfusion practitioner was something you needed in your hospital?
Yeah. So I don't know, so many years, some years ago in Amsterdam, I joined an ISBT working party meeting. It was a few years before COVID. I don't even remember, but I think from Mark Yezer was there, and I think it was the day Trump went into office. That somehow I remembered because of Mark. Okay, so you and Lindley presented an update about what you've done as transfusion practitioners. I never knew what that was before, and I was green with envy. I thought to myself, wow, we're doing a lot of talking, but nothing really happens. And here are some women that are really doing something because the errors in the blood bank and around the transfusion, let's say, blood bank, hospital doctors, etc., are very frequent, especially the near misses. The clinical staff, I think, is not aware of the dangers they face on a daily basis. They think to themselves, maybe subconsciously, this won't happen to me. I never make mistakes. And we've seen so many errors, and we keep on seeing them, that I, as a clinician, understand what it means not to catch one on time. So I thought to myself, this is something we need, and we need urgently. It doesn't exist in Israel, and I want to be the first that introduces this very important partner to our team.
Well, we are absolutely delighted that you did. You're such a pioneer for it. So can you tell us a bit about the TP role in your hospital? Sort of, how long have you had it now, and what are the responsibilities that they have?
So let me start that We started at the peak of the COVID pandemic in July 2020. We built the role based on your template from the ISBT. We more or less translated it from English to Hebrew. And we managed to get a nurse to do this. I'll tell you in one of the next questions. Our first challenge was we use there's different ways of taking a type and screen sample. So we used to have a system where every patient, the first time they're hospitalized, has two samples taken. So what happened was it was one sample divided into two. And the other option is two identifiers each time. So what made me change was when I asked a group of young interns, are you gonna take two samples, raise your hands, and no one raised their hands. And I said, okay, we have to change. So we made the decision to change, and then the COVID broke out. And so two identifiers for each patient, when a patient is in isolation and you have to put on the whole thing, is not easy. So what we did is we'd already changed our working procedures. And the first challenge of RTP was to teach all the hospital nursing and doctor staff the new procedure and to help implement it. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't really wasn't easy. I'll just give you an example. You need two identifiers. So one of our first samples we get, the patient is one of the identifiers, which I must say is a great startup, but it's not what's meant. So we had to teach the doctors and the nurses what to do. And that was the first task. The second implementation was to try and collect all the errors and go and teach people online. You know, you made an error today. Let's see why it happened, how we can prevent it. So that was the beginning of the role, and we're still there. We're working on ways to reduce errors online, and I think we're already, you know, there's been a change. There are less, at least type and screen samples come in with a sticker, usually with more than one identifier. They don't always sign, but you know, you must know this from
Yeah.
your work.
And it's good when you start to see those small changes because it makes you realize there's an impact. So we all know that the first step is getting a business case because we all live in the healthcare setting that requires funding. So how did you go about starting that process for a business case?
So I don't know if it was a business case, but I met with the senior management of the nurses and with the risk management team. And I've been here for almost 30 years, heading the blood bank already. Time flies when you enjoy it. And we've managed, and there have been quite a few near misses, and like in every hospital, there's been also serious adverse events. So I decided, with the backing of the risk management team, to meet with the head nurse of the hospital and present this subject to her. And to tell you the truth, I was sure she'd send me home and say, you know, what are you talking about? And surprisingly enough, she said, you know what? Great, I'm going to give you a full-time nurse to do this. And the reason she really agreed was when I came to the hospital, she was also a younger nurse, and we sat together and wrote the standard operating procedure for a type and screen. And I think she really understood the importance. And if you're involved in this, you see what happens in the in you know when you're in the departments. And there's a lack of communication between the departments and the blood bank. And I mean, I don't have time to go and inquire each time what happened. We'd planned to do it and it never happened. And we figured it would be great to have someone who works with us, who knows the staff, who's respected by both sides, by the blood bank, by the doctors, by the nurses. And you know, it wasn't even really a business case. It was a professional case, and it was professionally approved. So And then I brought to them your template and we translated it and worked on it so that it looked good to them, and we decided to, to start. So that's actually how it came about to be.
That's excellent. And I think you make a very good point there that sometimes you need to go and talk to the people who understand these. It's so important. I think, as you say, that nurse probably knowing the history of blood transfusion in your hospital, it did make a big deal. Have friends that understand blood transfusion. And I think that's a good thing for the listeners to talk to the risk managers as well.
Also approved.
Yeah. So once the nurse, I'm going to move on to our question about the challenges that in building. So once that had been agreed, and I was aware that it all happened during COVID, so life was in a very different space then. But were there any challenges in then meeting your nurse and working out what she would do and how she would settle in?
Actually, no. We already had a second nurse because our first nurse was moved up. But our first nurse, her name was Ella, and she was very keen, and we immediately saw eye to eye. And with the also the we worked together as a threesome. The PhD that heads the lab, the blood bank, me as a clinician, and her. And we talked about all the problems and we decided to, to start working. So one of the first times our TP went to educate the staff in was a surgical department. I'll never forget this. We're sitting there. She's presenting the case, how you have to work. A young surgeon gets up and says, "Oh, you in the Olympus. You're telling us how to work. You haven't got a clue what's going on. So you probably know this." So we said, "What Olympus? We treat patients. We managed to convince her that we are part of the field." And I think, yeah, after you talk to the people in the field, at least while they're listening to you, they're convinced. What happens afterwards? It's not easy. I think one of the problems is keeping things up, because somehow people. You tell them, you teach them, they do an e-learning course. 5 minutes later, the doctor he's about to take a blood sample. He has a phone call. In another room, there's a resuscitation. He forgets where he's going. He goes to the wrong room. I mean, it's not easy. So our TP, one of the things she did is tell him, "Okay, you have a phone call. You're not going to the patient. Don't even start. Put everything aside. You finish what you're doing. You start from the beginning. You try and think who you're going to go to. Then you take all the stickers, papers, whatever with you and start." But it's not easy. It's quite challenging.
Yeah, I think you're right about going to the people so that I think for me, it's important that they know who I am and that I'm very visible. And as you say, the surgeons are sort of, well, what do you know about blood transfusion surgery? But actually, if you make that point, were there any sort of lessons learned that you've come from, sort of, or I think we sometimes call them the aha moment. So you sort of alluded to it anyway, but anything that over the last few months, you thought, you know, this is so worthwhile. This is a good thing.
One thing I learned is fight for what you believe, and don't get discouraged. I mean, if you go and present a case, people will hear you, they won't listen to you the first time maybe. But pursue it. Go the second time, the third time, the fourth time. In the end, they'll say, "Okay, this person is nagging us for a reason. Let's listen to her." And I think if you believe in what you are doing, don't give up, and you'll get there. Also, this is getting the case approved, but also when you're talking to doctors, I mean, it's not easy. I think if you do succeed in convincing someone of the importance of doing things properly, and this is in the case of blood transfusion, but it applies to giving penicillin to someone who's allergic to penicillin, it's, I always say, it's not only transfusion. We need to know what we're doing. It's not enough to quote the latest article in the New England Journal of Medicine or in the Lancet. It's important. And another thing is, I think students, medical students, should be also educated in this. I teach medical students now, and in the it's the Ariel Medical School, and I started a few years ago giving them a meeting with them and showing them a movie. We prepared a small movie where we're taking a nurse. Ella actually was with me, the head of the lab, and me, and there was an actress, and we my husband was the patient's father, and there was an actor who was the patient, and we were taking a blood sample from a woman with abdominal pain for the movie, and she was screaming, and we were so, stressed out by this that we didn't identify her. We took the sample from the wrong patient. So this could end in two different ways. One, we give the wrong blood and the patient dies, and the other, the blood bank phones us. So we decided, because it's medical students, we won't start with the most severe thing. We'll do it that the blood bank calls and says there's been a mistake here. And we used two names. One was Coco Chanel, and the other was Coco Beaton. Never mind. So that's and then we show another short part of how the correct way it has to be done. I've been doing this for a few years. In October, I'm start meeting with them again, and then in this second half of the meeting, they do a simulation where they have to tell the patient and her husband or his wife or etc. that a mistake has been done, and another sample has to be taken. And we hope that maybe talking to medical students about this will sink in, that when they, a few years later, get there, maybe they'll remember this encounter. It would be good if we could pursue it along the teaching, but I think it's not enough to start with things like this with doctors. I think it has to be taught to medical students. I know that nursing students in Israel do learn about risk management and error prevention. It's physicians who don't need to know that they can make mistakes, and we're trying to change that. So
And also, a medical students will know transfusion practitioners are part of the transfusion world because that's what they know. They've met, as you say, Ella was part of the video, and as we move forward, so I think that's great. Get them when they're young is the phrase we sometimes use. So, have you set any targets or milestones for the role as we move forward now? Because you're a while in. It's been a couple of years. So what's next? Do you think of anything that's moving forward or where you might go with it? Maybe more transfusion practitioners?
I don't know if we'll have more, but we are seeking to reduce the number of errors. And we would like to be able to measure this. And also to see if our transfusion practitioner educates the young interns. So we hope to do a study where we ask them about their attitudes before they've had their meeting with her, and afterwards, and into their internship, not just on the same day, to see if anything has changed. And in parallel with that, we try to see if we can reduce as much as possible the near misses. The problem is that staff changes all the time. Their internship here is 1 year, so they finish and go, and then you have a new group coming in, and it's a problem.
Think that would be a really interesting piece of work because I think you've really nailed it. What impact do we have as transfusion practitioners? And although we can talk about it, actually, you know as well as I do, having some facts to demonstrate, actually, by training these new doctors, these new interns, it does have an impact. I'm very excited you have a transfusion practitioner. I really am.
Me too.
Do you so I suppose as we move towards the end, is there anything you'd like to share with the listeners, any resources you have or anything that you've learned from this that if anybody was planning on doing this, that some pearls of wisdom, some bits of advice that because we really want transfusion practitioners everywhere. So is there anything you'd like to sort of share at the end?
First of all, we have presented this in Israel because we think every hospital should have at least one transfusion practitioner. We think a transfusion practitioner is a pearl, a diamond. And if we want, and we want our patients to go home alive and safe. So we do believe that we really need a dedicated, I mean, not everyone can be a transfusion practitioner. You need a person who is confident to deal with doctors, who believes in what she does. Our transfusion practitioner now is a nurse in the emergency room. So she really knows what it's like to be in a situation where things are happening. And I believe that cooperation. First of all, you have to know who you, to choose the best person who can be a transfusion practitioner. And working together, we meet every 2 to 3 weeks. We have ongoing meetings, and we talk about things that come up during the. I don't know. We change forms. We things that you know. Suddenly, you're supposed to. The patient has to sign that he agrees to get a blood transfusion, and in Israel, two nurses administer the transfusion. So there was a question that should we. There's a checklist, so maybe there should be on the checklist something that you check that the patient has given his consent, because if you give the transfusion and don't check, for it's just an example of things that come up on our. We have a working schedule, a meeting, we have a working meeting, and all sorts of things you, I imagine if we didn't have a transfusion practitioner, these things wouldn't come up, and they we'd be we wouldn't even realize that we're not doing things properly. To have someone who's focused on this very important subject and is willing to always be available and have new ideas, and I mean, that's what's important to my knowledge.
You're like the greatest cheerleader for the transfusion practitioner role. I love it. Thank you so much. And I think you both agree that we'll both agree that the teamwork is really what makes it work. And meeting with you meeting with your TP regularly, I do the same. And it and I love the fact that they're the eyes and ears of transfusion on the ground. And that consent on the checklist is a fantastic example. Oh, thank you, Naomi, so much for sharing your time and experiences.
You said you love it. We have to love what we're doing. So if
Yes.
we all love what we're doing, we'll want to do it best and enjoy doing it. It's, you know, we come to work every day happy that we're doing something important. So, and I really
Absolutely.
believe this. I mean,
Yeah.
it's my take-home message.
Well, I think it's the best take-home message. So we've learned from you that transfusion practitioners have played such an important role now in your hospital and your healthcare and improving patients' experiences. Thank you so much to the listeners for joining us today. If you have any feedback, please use the questions linked with the podcast. If you have any further questions, you can link in with us by visiting the ISBT website and checking out the Clinical Transfusion Working Party, where you will find more details about the transfusion practitioner subgroup. We look forward to having you join us for our next episode, where we're going to start exploring countries that have implemented non-medical authorization of blood. So that is nurses prescribing blood and blood components and the governance required to do so. Until then, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you.